The reservoir of all qualities. Jive. Under the designations. Maya Maye. The reservoir of all potencies. Yada. Placed. Tam. That. Cha. Also. Anushayam. Designation. Atmastam, situated in self-realization. Aso, he, Anushayi, the living entity. Bhuman, the enjoyer. Jnana, knowledge. Vairagya, renunciation. Viryena, by the prowess of Svarupastaha, being situated in one's constitutional position. Ajaha, returned home. Prabhu, the controller. Just 1 second. Heißt es nochmal? Arkadios heißt es. Du verstehst Englisch noch nicht so gut, oder? So gut wie gar nicht, sozusagen. Da kommt also noch eine Übersetzung. So, let us now go to the translation. Again, Prabhus, it is a highly technical text and it will require the best of your concentration in order to absorb its meaning. Prithu Maharaj then offered the total designation of the living entity unto the supreme controller of illusory energy. Being released from all the designations by which the living entity became entrapped, he became free by knowledge and renunciation and by the spiritual force of his devotional service. In this way, being situated in his original constitutional position of Krishna consciousness, he gave up this body as a Prabhu, or controller of the senses. As stated in the Vedas, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the source of material energy. Consequently, he is sometimes called Maya Maya, or the Supreme Person who can create his pastimes through his potency known as the material energy. The jiva, or the individual living entity, becomes entrapped by the material energy, by the supreme will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In Bhagavad Gita 18:61, we understand Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridesho Junatishtati Brahmayam Sarvabhutani Yantra Rudhani Mayaya. Ishvara, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is situated within the heart of all conditioned souls. And by his supreme will, the living entity or individual soul gets the facility to lord it over material nature and various types of bodies, which are known as yantra, or the moving vehicle offered by the total material energy maya. Yantra rudhani mayaya. Although the individual living entity, jiva, and the lord are both situated within the material energy, the Lord is directing the movements of the jiva soul by offering him different types of bodies through the material energy. Thus, the living entity is wandering throughout the universes in various forms of body and becomes implicated in different situations, partaking of the reactions of fruitive activities. Then Prithu Maharaj became spiritually powerful by the enhancement of his spiritual knowledge, jnana, and renunciation of material desires, he became a prabhu, or master of his senses, sometimes called Goswami or Swami. Please, it is interesting to note the word prabhu is explained here as master of his senses. You know, of course, that we address each other as prabhus. So this is like with this we couldn't say, prabhu, you eat too much. This wouldn't be the right address any longer, because if he eats too much, he is not a prabhu or master of his senses. Very interesting way to look at things. And this means that he was no longer controlled by the influence of material energy, this prabhu. When one is strong enough to give up the influence of material energy, he is called prabhu. In this verse, the word svarupastaha is also very significant. The real identity of the individual soul lies in understanding or attaining the knowledge that he is eternally a servant of Krishna. This understanding is called svarupabholabdhi. By culturing devotional service, the devotee gradually comes to understand his actual relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This understanding of one's pure spiritual position is called svarupalabdhi. And when one attains that stage, he can understand how he is related with the Supreme Personality of Godhead as a servant or friend, or as a parent or conjugal lover. The stage of understanding is called svarupastaha. Prithu Maharaj realized this svarupa completely, and it will be clear in later verses that he personally left this world or this body by riding on a chariot sent from Vaikuntha. In this verse, the word prabhu is also significant. As stated before, when one is completely self-realized and acts according to that position, he can be called prabhu. The spiritual master is addressed as Prabhupada because he is completely self-realized soul. The word pad means position, and Prabhupada indicates that he is given the position of Prabhu, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, for he acts on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Unless one is a Prabhu or controller of the senses, he cannot act as spiritual master, who is authorized by the Supreme Prabhu or Lord Krishna. In his verse praising the spiritual master, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, Sakshat Hari Tvena Samasta Sashtareya Uktastatha Bhavyata Eva Shakti. The spiritual master is honored as much as the Supreme Lord, because he is the most confidential servitor of the Lord. Thus, Prithu Maharaj can also be called Prabhupada, or as described here in Prabhu. Another question may be raised in this connection. Since Prithu Maharaj was a power incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Shakti Avesh Avatar, why did he have to execute the regulative principles in order to become a Prabhu? Because he appeared on this earth as an ideal king, and because it is the duty of the king to instruct the citizens in the execution of devotional service, he followed all the regulative principles of devotional service in order to teach others. Similarly, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, although Krishna himself taught us how to approach Krishna as a devotee, it is said, Apani Achari Bhakti Shikainu Sabhade. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructed others in the process of devotional service by setting the example himself through his own personal actions. Similarly, Prithu Maharaj, although a Shaktyavesh avatar incarnation, still behaved exactly as a devotee in order to achieve the position of Prabhu. Furthermore, Swarupasthaha means complete liberation. As it is said, Bhagavatam 2.10.6. Uwe, kannst du mir mal das Bhagavatam holen? Das ist der zweite Kanto mit dem 10. Kapitel drin. In Englisch, wenn es geht. Hidvanyata rupam svarupena yavastita. When a living entity abandons the activities of Maya and attains the position from which he can execute devotional service, his state is called svarupasthaha, or complete liberation. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimade Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavari Bhaskatyade Shatarine Jaya Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadara Srivasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. In this today's text we find a couple of interesting points which we would like to focus upon as to bring some more Krishna conscious understanding about in the minds of the devotees here. Let me just get clearance on one point and then we can start. Yes. Abhavandan Dipavati. Yes. Today I would like actually to address a very a point, and I'm very happy that this text is giving us some further information how to understand this point. This point is an attempt to understand our conditional nature within the modes of material nature. Like we practically all here are aware that we are conditioned souls who are dependent on the actions and reactions of different material modes upon our chitta, that means unpurified consciousness. The pure soul is completely transcendental to the modes of material nature because he actually is situated in his Svarupa Siddhi. But the impure soul is not transcendental to the modes of material nature, even though he may have a theoretical understanding that he is transcendent, that he has nothing to do with this world. Now, before starting, I would like to ask all of you, who has read Albert Camus? Camus, yes. You write him Camus? Or you say Camus? Camus, yeah. When you say it in the French. You have read him a little bit. So. Anyone else here? Yes. Good. See, we are addressing the point that in theory someone might understand that he is a stranger in this world, who has nothing to do with the actions and reactions of material energy upon him. But if he is not sufficiently purified in his consciousness, he cannot help but become influenced. A lot of scientists, thinkers in the Western culture do actually understand that this material life cannot be all in all. They understand it from different angles of vision. For instance, a scientist he lives in the illusion that everything what happens here is, so to say, atoms which move according to certain physical laws. And with this understanding, actually everything is more or less all right. There is no sin and no piety. You just move about by your own desires, and these desires are not essentially good or bad, they're just different from other people's desires. So you cannot be really held responsible for any action which you do. This kind of thought is the background of atheism and shows you how absolutely dangerous this philosophy can be. If there is no God who has given certain rules, like Krishna says in the Gita, where he describes that the material nature and everything is working under his rules, then you can just as well, in a relative world, establish your own rules and regulations. So the atheists, for instance, don't take material life so super serious. It is described that Camus, he had a feeling of senselessness of this world, and therefore he committed suicide at a very early time in his life, because he thought, well, it's just atoms and it's so much trouble to maintain one's life. Why should I just become a slave to certain standards which material society sets upon me? Can just as well end this meaningless play of atom, and then at least there is some peace, you know. So many understand what I've just said from the Vedic perspective, that they have a similar outlook almost as the devotees. The devotee understands, but this material energy is just Krishna's, it's just a lower energy, and this material life doesn't really make any sense. Of course, the conclusion of the devotee is that the only life which makes sense is to serve Krishna in loving devotion, that they don't have. But the first part is almost the same. And I want to make you this a little, give you a little understanding, because all of you who have come to Krishna consciousness at one time or another have thought about the meaningless and senselessness of material life. But because you were not purified in your minds, you couldn't give up material life. Just like for the figure in Albert Camus' writing, the stranger, der Fremde. The book starts with he didn't know if his mother died today or yesterday, or was it yesterday? He couldn't say for sure any longer. This is how the book starts. Very depressing start. Describes that state which many conditioned souls feel, a state of estrangement from the so-called reality. That really doesn't matter what happened so far. And then it is describing how this main figure of the book, I forgot exactly, I mean it's so long back and it's and this person, some vile story. The detail doesn't matter. Yes, right. He lived his life, and then somehow he was involved in a crime. He committed a murder, and later, see, and he didn't really want it. It just so happened that he did it. He felt so much distant from the actual act of doing it. But still, this is interesting, he was captured by the police and he suffered. So this is very nicely describing the state of an unenlightened conditioned soul who enters this material world and who finds out pretty soon how he is a victim to external circumstances which are arranging themselves before him due to the law of karma, obviously. This is what we know. And all this while acting, he almost feels himself like a stranger, like being not there, but by seeing it, by just observing what is happening around. This is happening to quite a lot of people, and I'm sure all of those who are sitting here, that means who have become devotees, know about this. You usually find in the life of a devotee that at one stage in his life, the false ego, the false identification with something of this material world was disturbed, or disturbed sounds almost morbid, it was slackened a little bit. One was thinking, what am I doing? Like I remember one Bhakta who was very much engaged in sports. One day when he ran around the sportsplatz, the sports arena, just destroying his mind and his body, he thought, what am I actually doing here? Or some of you might have danced in a discotheque to a different melody than the Hare Krishna Kirtan, and some of you might have felt, what am I actually doing here? This is completely foolish. And you might have sit on a table in the discotheque and drunken a glass of fruit juice or some unmentionable substance, and you might have thought, this doesn't make any sense any longer. I remember when I was a little boy, I was constantly feeling this, that my identification was no longer there with this. I was sitting in the school and they were talking, teachers were talking and talking about wind and climate zones and genetic codex and DNS, and I was just thinking, I'm not interested in this. Why do I have to listen to this? And I was just, my mind was spacing out, thinking of swimming in the ocean and other things. This is a natural feeling for every conditioned soul, but our materialistic society, which is governed so much by false ego and by kamatmika, it's called in Sanskrit, the mentality that you do have to become successful by working for certain material results, this material society doesn't really allow this. in the school, there are the school psychologists which are preaching to the children who are feeling this, that they should get more into it, make good notes, because after all, if they do not make good notes, their future is highly uncertain and unpredictable. In materialistic society, when you come out of the school, you become indoctrinated by material society to get into something concrete. Usually it is the sexual attraction by which Maya captures all the conditioned souls, because as soon as you become sexually stimulated, you become enthusiastic to make a certain environment which is conducive to this stimulus. In other words, you feel, well, I should have at least have an apartment or some and some car if possible, or at least a bicycle with two seats on it that we can go together through the streets and go on picnic, and so on, it's in the forests, and so on and so forth. In fact, there is a theory which Prabhupada actually quotes. It's a Marshall theory, it's called. You can read it in Prabhupada Lilamrita. This theory states that sexual attraction between man and woman is the basis of economic advancement. Wirtschaftlicher Fortschritt, how do we say? Economic advancement, isn't it? Development, economic development, we say. So, because this sexual attraction usually is so strong, that people are prepared really to get into life, take it serious, take an apartment, get a decent clothing together, soak their bodies regularly, and anointed with musk and perfumes, and in this way conduct the materialistic affairs. So you can see that in our Vedic scriptures there are several interesting examples of great souls who have taken this understanding that why should we endeavor in this material world? After all, it doesn't really make so much sense to work like crazy for something which you have to lose today or tomorrow. There are many great saints who have taken on their conclusions. See, a materialist may have this feeling of being a stranger in this world, but he is not able actually to act on this realization because he is a complete robe, servant of his material desires. So he may sometimes feel, what is the meaning of this life anyways? But then he thinks, well, at least let me have some sexual relationships in this. And then all of a sudden he becomes active in the material field. Or he thinks, okay, it doesn't make any meaning, but if I at least could be glorious and a little famous, then let me, you know, become a good sportsman or a good musician or a rich man and so on and so forth, and try to enjoy as much and as irresponsibly as possible this material life. In other words, he is in a schizophrenic situation. He cannot live according to his own understandings because of a contaminated mind and heart. So the great souls of the past have understood this and have therefore set upon a path of controlling the senses and the mind. And there is, of course, the impersonalistic yoga path, whereby which people try to give up their sensual attraction, and they do this by imposing, aufzwingen, severe hardships on their bodies and minds. See, it's almost when you have a child which is very, the mind and the senses can be compared with a child. Those who know children know that sometimes a child will develop a completely irresponsible and actually unimportant desire. The child wants to have something irresponsible and actually unimportant desire. The child wants to have something which is really not very important, but if he doesn't get it, he will just scream and he will do anything to get it. Sometimes they become very, very dangerous. I remember when I was a child, my parents were always playing this classical music in our house, and I was just, and there was a time when I couldn't hear this doodle-doodle-doo any longer, and I desired somehow, the crazy desire, to destroy the whole, all of the records of my parents. So when they were on holiday, I went with a sharp knife to the record collection and I scratched all the records because I wanted to hear something else than always the same records with the same boring mental music. This was dangerous. I mean, we lost maybe several thousands of marks because of this crazy desire. Anyways, now I don't think it's so crazy, this desire, but it's a little crazy at least. This is children. They have no responsibility. They don't think, oh, my father and my mother, they like this music somehow so much. It gives them something, it helps them through their daily life, you know, and I shouldn't, just because I don't like it, be so cruel to destroy the whole attachment of them. They can't think so far. This is exactly how our senses are. They are like little children. If somehow they want to have something, want to do something, then they don't care about the consequences. This is seen in the life of uncontrolled and unregulated people. They will give a promise, but because all of a sudden their minds and senses have a different idea, they don't keep these promises. You might know these people are very something. So therefore, just as sometimes children are punished, it's not very effective, but sometimes the mother just beats the children. Don't do it again. Like my parents, when they found out, I remember I had to suffer so much. First they were beating me, then they were not giving me my favorite sweet any longer. Couldn't get my sweet. My mother usually used to cook everything I liked. But then she would only cook potatoes and apples, which I didn't like at all. I was severely punished by this. And, you know, I had to be a good boy for half a year. Then only they were again friendly. This is a way also yogis act with their childlike minds and senses. They punish them. No! Sit in the cold. No, we won't go in the warm room. No, you have to now become inactive. You may not do. You have to sit under water. You have to sit in the heat. And in this way, they learn to very strongly say no to the senses until finally the senses and mind, that is their hope, become burnt out and they do not demand anything anymore, these foolish things which entangle them in this material world. But as we of course know, this process usually doesn't work. There in the scriptures we hear many, many examples how the mind and the senses can be subdued for some time, but after some time they become again very strong and demanding. So in Krishna consciousness, and with this point we want to end, we do have actually a positive process. Yes, we agree with the existentialists and the yogis. Camus is an existentialist, by the way. I'm just saying, in case you didn't know that this philosophy is called existentialism. I mean, it's no harm if you don't know. But we agree with this, with the stranger, the point which was made in the stranger, the book The Stranger, and with the yogis. In as much as we also think this material life doesn't make any sense, and we are, the soul is a stranger here in this material life. But we do not agree with the conclusions. We have a very positive way of going about it. And any devotee who takes up, who understands this process in his life, he will become very, very happy person atma. He will lose his interest in the material world, na sochati and na kankshati. He will, because his senses are positively engaged in Krishna's transcendental service. Someone who does engage his service, his senses, at the beginning it is a little difficult, because the senses and the mind, as we said, are like children. Like we see a new bhakta, smoking in the toilet all of a sudden. You come in the toilet and you know, ooh, who was this? Then, in a minute or so, you have him, you know him, and who it was. You go to him, well, do you have to do this on the toilet? I mean, if you can't control your mind, can't you be like a human being and do it in the forest at least, or somewhere by the sticky toilet? See how, and then next step, see how your mind and senses have tricked you. They have put you in the toilet just so that you see what kind of addiction this is. And then usually he will feel bad about himself, not about you saying it to him, but about him, his mind and his senses, and he might be able to say no forever. So this is this is what the mind and the senses, in the beginning they are very hard to control, and they are very difficult to, they are very childlike. But if a devotee learns to engage his senses positively in Krishna's service, then he is very, very much helped. Like one, we talked about this Saturday, one very nice way to engage all the senses in Krishna's service is if you do kirtan. If you dance, really dance, not stand around like a camel, but dance in abundance for the pleasure of Krishna. And sing real loud, concentrate your mind. Afterwards you feel something. Well, this was transcendental. It was a very nice experience. So there are other ways and means, of course, to engage the senses in Krishna's service. Another point is your service. When you really accept that this service has been given to me so that I can satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you will see how you become very happy in your devotional service. If you just see your service as some way to kill the time, or if you see your service as something which, or if your service maybe is not service at all, maybe you just make arrangement so that you can be happy in this life and thereafter, and just do certain things, then you won't feel this pleasure. But if you engage your senses and your mind 100% in the service of Krishna, you will feel no longer like a stranger, disoriented, and so on and so forth, but you will feel like Krishna's eternal soul. I wanted now to end this by reading Prabhupada's wonderful purport to the verse where he describes a liberated soul. You might have remembered there is one shloka in the Bhagavatam, second canto, chapter 10, verse number 6. I will just read the last two lines because that's really what we want, what is necessary. And usually Prabhupada only quotes these two lines. Muktir hi vanyata rupam svarupena vyavastiti. Liberation, or you could also say freedom, is the permanent situation of the form of the living entity after he gives up the changeable, gross, and subtle material bodies. Just like Prithu Maharaj, he gave up the gross and subtle body and experienced full liberation from material existence. So this is the Svarupa, the natural identical position of the living entity, to be full of freedom. So let me read you from this wonderful purport. The material conditional bodies develop out of the living entity's forgetfulness of their relationship with Godhead. And during the course of the cosmic manifestation, the conditioned souls are given a chance to revive their original status of life with the help of revealed scriptures, so mercifully compiled by the Lord in his different incarnations. Reading or hearing of such transcendental literatures helps one become liberated even in the conditional state of material existence. All the Vedic literatures aim at devotional service to the personality of Godhead, and as soon as one is fixed upon this point, he at once becomes liberated from conditional life. The material gross and subtle forms are simply due to the conditional soul's ignorance, and as soon as he is fixed in the devotional service of the Lord, he becomes eligible to be freed from the conditioned state. This devotional service is transcendental attraction for the Supreme on account of his being the source of all pleasing humors. Everyone is after some pleasure of humor for enjoyment, but does not know the supreme source of all attraction. Rasavai saha rasam hevayam latvanandi bhavati. So this is really the answer. By the Vedic scriptures, by the sound of the Vedic scriptures, we are shown a path which leads to devotional service, engagement in devotional service. And by engaging in that devotional service in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the living entity tastes a lot of rasa. Rasa. Like Shesha Deva would say, rosh. Huh? Yes, rosh. By this experience of a transcendental wohlgeschmack, mellow is the English word, in devotional service, you can give up your estranged condition in this material world and return back to Krishna. So, thank you very much for listening to these points. I hope they were of interest to you. Do you have any questions regarding this? Vatsalya Rasa Prabhu.
So I have an argument that usually agnostics, so I would be interested to know what is your answer. You were describing how the existentialists, they think that everything is more or less meaningless.
Yes.
Therefore, many may become disappointed or disgusted that they seem just kill myself. And in the same way, the devotees find a meaning to their life. If we could analyze both situations as a psychological disposition of the mind. One is thinking himself useless or meaningless, another thinking himself, I'm a servant of God, but it's just in the mind. And therefore one think himself happy and the other think himself distressed, but both situations are just mental creation.
Very nice point. See, this point was addressed by Jean-Paul Sartre, the guru of the existentialists. But not in a book. I mean, maybe one letter, I think a letter to a friend or so. It is in written form. I mean, it's not that we just say it. He says, my philosophy has one fault. Although I'm saying everything moves by chance and so on and so forth, there are certain factors which are there as laws. They are there. For instance, death. I don't want to die, but I have to die. See? There's something which is beyond his control. See, the conclusion of the existentialist is nothing makes sense. To die, at a time which I have not under my control, I have to die. That's very bad. And then he said, and therefore, but and I'm always striving to overcome this, to not experience defeat. So, therefore, I'm concluding that I'm always going towards a perfected stage. Just out of this seems to be my mechanism. Anyways, but the main point of the main way I would answer the argument is like this: the materialist or existentialist says there is no controller, there is no God, and he can more or less do in a relative world as he thinks fit. But still, he's always disturbed. He's always experiencing, if he does certain things, there is a certain reaction. In other words, there is sense. The world is highly ordered. And the minute he goes against that implicit order, so to say, the minute he suffers. So it's not just, see, he is on the mentality niveau, on the mental platform, totally, because the world is not the way he thinks it is. Now, a Krishna conscious devotee, on the other side, is believing there is a God, and he begins to work on this principle, accepting this principle, and look at his life. It is not that he's just thinking there is Krishna who supplies him with all he needs. He experiences it. Especially in Vrindavan, if you're as a person, as a devotee, not totally convinced of this, that Krishna takes care of you, you should surrender more to Krishna, and you will see how he actually does, how he arranges your life, how not by chance everything is happening, but how Krishna is really there in the life. I know that. See, there here comes the difference between an advanced devotee and a devotee in name only. A little advanced devotee, he can understand how Krishna is there in his life. And in fact, it is highly advised by Bhaktivinoda Thakur to think about this. Actually, also Prabhupada, he trains us to think in this way about our lives. He says, when you do a service, you should understand, this service is given to me by Krishna. And you will see how Krishna responds. So the devotee's life is not on the mental platform. I would even say, if all of us would be on the mental platform, we wouldn't be together here. This movement for Krishna consciousness would not be possible. I mean, if you look into our... anyways, I don't want to... You never know where the cassettes go, but... let me just say as much here. If you look at our situation in this world, having temples, having this, having that. It is not by a clever business plan, but it's by Krishna's mercy only. You can ask Vishvadev, who has to deal with these figures, numbers, you know, income, outgo, and so on and so forth. And many times the manager knows, you know, the hardcore manager who really is there, and he watches all this so-called, the situation. He knows many times Krishna just helped. Otherwise, we would be in a catastrophe. So Krishna is very much there in the life of a devotee. He appears when you chant the holy name. He purifies your consciousness. He gives you clarity in certain aspects of your life, certain major decisions. Should you do this? Should you do that? Should you and so on and so forth. This Krishna consciousness movement is meant to serve Krishna and to feel how one is guided by Krishna through the spiritual master. And everyone who wants, and we need to do our activities in this consciousness, and then we will understand Daivim Prakritim Ashrita, how we are under the shelter of the divine energy. I could now, this would be another lecture. Maybe I should give this lecture in sometimes, you know, to show the devotees practically about the Krishna factor in their lives. Because sometimes we may not, because it is also, we are so accustomed to this lifestyle which we are leading now, that we may become a little bit too familiar with the life of devotional service, and therefore just don't oversee the many instances where Krishna comes into life. And at the time of death, Krishna takes care of his devotee also. It's not mental, it's very practical. And you could say, I mean, now I have answered this question for devotees. For existentialists, I would say, look at the devotees. They are getting free from their bad karma. I mean, their life becomes highly auspicious. They don't care for anything any longer. I mean, it works. They're not disturbed by anything any longer. They may imagine there is no God, but they are constantly disturbed. And the laws of nature are constantly punishing them when they do something wrong. But the devotee is living in harmony with Krishna and his life is all right. Sorry, I'm not so much in the debating mood. Maybe when this question comes by an agnostic, I become a little bit more fiery. But this is the way I would answer it in this circle. Good. Let us come to a conclusion here. Hare Krishna.